It's better over here.
After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
This is the secret story of a young Russian oligarch who hacked his way to a $93 million fortune. I'm CNBC senior Washington correspondent Eamon Javers. In our new podcast, The Crimes of Putin's Traitor, I'll take you inside a shocking Russian crime targeting the American financial system. Attacks that sources tell me were welcomed by Vladimir Putin's government. Listen to CNBC's The Crimes of Putin's Traitor free on the Odyssey app.
From KMOX Sports.
Okay, boys, here we go.
Welcome to the Gray Bar Sports Open Line.
Those mid swings, and he hits a drive. He hits a slammer.
Gray Bar, your distributor for electrical and datacom needs.
Here we go.
Now, Matt Pauley on America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
All right, man, let's get going here.
Here we go.
Let's go.
A little bit past 6 o'clock, we are underway with the Gray Bar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. Welcome into the program. My name is Matt Pauley, taking you until 8 o'clock this evening. As always, if you want to chime in, multiple ways to get connected with the program, calling, texting, tweeting, voice messaging, 314-436-7900. 314-436-7900 is how you call or text. You tweet at me, at Matt Pauley on air, or you voice message us via the Odyssey app. We got a lot going on the program. Tonight, a special hello to everybody driving into downtown St. Louis right now, getting ready for St. Louis Blues hockey this evening. The Blues are opening up the home portion of their schedule tonight, and they are going to match up against the Minnesota Wild. Puck drop is scheduled for about 20 minutes from now. I'm not trying to go anywhere near political or social topics here. I like it when downtown St. Louis feels like there's stuff going on. And it doesn't always feel that way. Even at times during the Cardinal season, there were times where crowds were so low that you just didn't really have that big game feeling, big event feeling. And I like it when stuff's going on in downtown St. Louis. I like it when multiple venues are having events. Now, if I'm at one of those venues and I'm sitting in traffic afterwards because they all happen to let out at the exact same time, that's a little bit of a different story. But generally speaking, I like it when there's kind of a vibe in there or something in the air. And I kind of felt that today when I was driving in. There was a little bit more traffic coming in today than normal. I got to the station right around a little bit after 4 o'clock. And as I'm getting off of Highway 40 and I'm driving by the Enterprise Center, I see people wearing Blues jerseys all over the place. You know, a lot of pedestrian traffic. And I'm looking out the windows right now in our KMOX studios in downtown St. Louis, and I can see people walking around, and I see cars parked in all the parking spots. Like, it feels good that there is something going on. And the fact that it is the home opener tonight for the Blues, and I'm actually, generally speaking, I like it when you open up the season overall at home, but in a way, because of the results of the road trip, I kind of like this better. Because there's some excitement and some energy around this Blues team right now based off the fact that they went and they won 2 out of 3 to open up the season on the road, and they got good come-from-behind victories, and they were competitive against a good Vegas team. They could have potentially won that game. They were a goal away twice from being able to even it up, and who knows what would have happened from that point forward. So at least for me, I can't speak for everybody. Because if you were listening to me talk about the Blues leading into the Seattle game, I was kind of down on the team, low expectations. And not that I think this team is going to go compete for a Stanley Cup, but what I've seen through 3 games is I've seen a team that's got some resilience, that has some character, the team that's a little bit faster. We talked about this yesterday when we had Andy Strickland on. One of the things that was tough for me when watching the Blues, one of the reasons why I had kind of a negative feeling about them, was because when they were on the ice, with athletic, fast teams, you could just see the talent gap. It was just yelling at you, just spotlights showing off that they were not as talented as some of these other teams, not as athletic as some of these other teams. And I feel like with the additions that have been made and just kind of some tweaking of the roster, not that they're the most athletic team in the world, not that they're the fastest team in the world, but they're a little bit better. It's not as stark of a difference when you look at them compared to some of these really athletic clubs. So I have been very pleasantly surprised through the first three games. Clearly a tiny sample size, but in many ways, because they got off to a good start on the road, it almost adds something to what's going to be going on tonight as they do open up the home portion of the schedule, and hopefully they can keep things going. The big news today is that Brandon Saad is going to be back in the lineup. He's going to be reinserted back into that top line. So the top line for the Blues will have Thomas centering Saad along with Jake Neighbors. Then that second line is going to be Pavel Buchnevich centering Jordan Kyrou and Zach Bolduc. That's kind of a fun, exciting line when you think about Kyrou and Bolduc. Now, he's got... this may be a one last opportunity for Bolduc before potentially being sent back down, as they do have some other players that are going to be returning here sooner than later, and he could very easily be the odd man out. But he knows that. Let's see how he's able to respond tonight. They kept the WTF line in place, the fourth line, which has given pretty good work with Walker and Toropchenko and Fax. So they're going to be the fourth line continuing on. We'll see what's going to happen when a couple other guys do get healthy here moving forward. Kasperi Kapanen is the guy who's the odd man out as a result of Brandon Saad being back. Saad missed that entire three-game opening road trip. He and his wife were awaiting the birth of their third child. The child came. They now have two girls and one boy, and now he is back set to rejoin the lineup tonight. So we'll see what the Blues are able to do. They're a little bit closer to being the team that we expect them to be when fully healthy, with Saad back in there, and he's going to be able to be there at the top line working well with Robert Thomas and Jake Neighbors, and we'll see what happens here moving forward. But yeah, just the... something's in the air. It's the Blues home opener night. There's people in downtown St. Louis. It feels like there's some energy, some excitement, some momentum, all those things going on with this club right now. We've got a number of guests that are going to be on the program tonight. In just a few minutes, we're going to be joined by Lance Brzezowski, player development analyst in baseball. Had previously worked for Driveline Baseball, now with the Marquee Network. That's the group that carries Cubs baseball. Next hour, Jerry Palm is going to join us. We'll talk all things college basketball with him. Also, the weekly conversation that Patrick Mahomes has with Carrington Harrison with our sister station 96.5 The Fan in Kansas City. We'll run that next hour as well. It's all coming up. This is Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
We do roll on here on a Tuesday night, just one Major League Baseball playoff game this evening, Guardians-Yankees, and right now the Yankees lead that series 1-0. Of course, from a Cardinals standpoint, much of what we have been talking about this offseason has been connected to the organization's reset when it comes to player development. Chaim Bloom's going to come in and try to really redevelop the player development system. We're really happy right now to talk a little bit about the importance of player development and some other things as well. We welcome on to the program Lance Brzezowski. He's part of the team at Marquee Network. That's the group that broadcasts Cubs games. We won't hold that against him. Former remote video editor with Driveline Baseball as well. We've had Andrew Eitan on the program from Driveline. Paul Goldschmidt, Nolan Arenado, Lars Nootbaar have gone and worked out at Driveline in the offseason. So all that being said, we welcome Lance on to the program. Lance, thanks for taking some time with us today. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. Thanks for having me, man. This will be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. So, a lot of things to get in with you, and you. I mentioned you're part of the team at Marquee. You also have a YouTube channel, which is fantastic. And for people who really want to learn about development and some of the kind of really, truly inside baseball stuff when it comes to the way players are being developed. Your videos are really fantastic. And I was watching some of them recently, and you had a video that talked about individualized pitching, what teams really trying to make pitchers the best version of themselves. And essentially said, well, individualized pitching kind of doesn't, it's not really a thing. It's more about organizational philosophy. And what struck me when I was watching this is the Cardinals, a team that we think about as being pitch to contact and a team that we think about not really being focused on velocity, their minor leaguers, the fastball velocity was second to only the Dodgers. So talk me through that a little bit and what that potentially means for the Cardinals here moving forward.
Yeah, I'll take a couple angles on it. The first one is that it's good, right? Like, I think velocity is king. I think most people would agree. Now, I totally understand the people that don't agree, right? You have to command the ball, command comes first, et cetera, et cetera. But I think everything exists in a balance. And what's really occurred a lot in the last, you'd say even like 5 to 10 years in the minor league side and most front offices, is how important velocity is at least a baseline to have for a pitcher to then build command upon. There's been some other organizations that have kind of done the opposite, like the Guardians and such, who are seeing in the playoffs right now, who basically take lower velo guys with command and then build the velo up to like a tolerable threshold. But I view them more as an anomaly than a thing that is standard among most teams. So I was a bit surprised to see the Cardinals up there. Mm-hmm. And the cold water I'll pour is that there's a couple reasons they could be up there. Number one, a lot of this data that I'm looking at, which is like, basically, you're taking a plane up at 40,000 feet and looking down. You're not really digging into individual levels or players or whatever. I'm literally just like averaging everything together and seeing if I could find any trends. And I think there are certain teams that just have better pitching prospects, and that could influence things. So a Quinn Matthews, a Tink Hentz, TK Roby, some of the guys in the Cardinals organization that pop on most prospect lists, all throw pretty hard. And although that's only three pitchers and our sample's pretty big here, you know, over 30,000 pitches and such, it does matter, I think, for some of those guys, you know? So I think having some guys like that, it kind of can juice up the numbers slightly. You look at a team like the Yankees, who are actually, I have them as the third lowest forcing fastball velocity. Now, do they actually throw the third slowest? I'm not entirely sure. It could be a byproduct of them throwing a lot of cutters and that getting grouped in. So there's a lot of oddity here. But it is, I think, relevant to some extent that the Cardinals are that high up. I'm not sure how relevant, and it's something that I want to see on a year-over-year basis. But it's a good starting point to then leap off of for next year, I would say.
Yeah, and the other thing that's kind of odd when it comes to all this, so earlier this week, Derek Gould, who covers the Cardinals for the Post-Dispatch, our newspaper here, he wrote about how the Cardinals are really trying to focus in the minor leagues in having starting pitching going deeper into games, and that Cardinals starting pitchers in the minor leagues led all four full season levels in starting pitching innings, that they feel like that they need to get pitchers ready to pitch deeper into games, and that's something that we haven't seen a lot in the minor leagues recently, so a little bit of a change. When you throw more pitches, when you throw more innings, sometimes velocity goes down, so just taking your piece of information, combining that with what was reported earlier this week in the Post-Dispatch, I thought it made it even that much more interesting that fastball velocity across the board was up, even in a year where starting pitching was throwing more pitches than basically any other organization across the minor leagues.
That's a great note. Yeah, I didn't have that information, so that's perfect context, I think, to layer in. And I think that's an interesting approach when you think of, like, trying to find an edge. You know, like, you go back to, like, the Moneyball days, and everyone's like, well, why aren't the A's fantastic now? Or why have they not been great for the last couple of years? It's like, well, because it's a copycat league. Like, everyone just takes that idea and then applies it to their organization, and then you have to keep iterating, you know? Like, it's with any company. It doesn't even have to do with baseball. Like, you have to keep innovating and keep figuring out what your edge is going forward. So if the Cardinals think it could be an edge for them to have guys get more comfortable turning over lineups from, like, a mentality standpoint, you know, even just, like, getting guys comfortable in that respect, I could perhaps see some advantage to that long term. There's also the angle, you know, you get into like the workload pitcher injuries thing. We do this every April and May when everyone gets injured on their ramp ups. You know, it's like, what's happening? Why is everybody getting hurt? Everyone's throwing too hard, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that could be a byproduct of severe limits on innings and pitch totals in the minors, mm-hmm. to the point where, like, you have to build fitness, right? Fitness is the capacity to take on any kind of load, for example. So in pitching, that's how much you're throwing. So if you're going through the minors and just not throwing a ton, and then you then have to ramp even higher when you're, say, 23 years old and trying to make an impact. You know, you're 40-man eligible or Rule 5 eligible in the offseason, et cetera. Like, then your ramp comes. So I wonder whether they're trying to find a slight edge on a couple things here, and maybe that plays out to their advantage long term. The counter evidence would just be that all the really good teams of pitching development, like the Rays, the Dodgers, et cetera, I'd be curious what Gold has in them in terms of where they rank on that statistic, because I'm pretty sure a lot of those teams do not have their guys stretched out. So it's like you're gambling that you're smarter than the four or five teams that have done this really well for the last three, 4 years, and that might be a really bold bet.
When it specifically comes to Team Cance, and this, I keep bringing this up because when you think about a guy that you want to be a major league starter, minimum, you want him to be able to throw, 150, 160 innings? That would be kind of the minimum number. 2 years ago in 2023, Hintz got to 96 innings. This past year, he dealt with injuries, and he didn't even get to 80. So 96 is his career high in innings pitched. Never this past season, he's coming off 80. You don't want to increase workload too much year over year. I'm having a hard time seeing the pathway towards Hintz being an 150-inning major league guy within the next 2 years.
Yeah, that's totally fair point. You know, I think we've seen some minor instances of very large increases of late. You know, I think of like a Justin Steele on the Cubs. I think of a Garrett Crochet on the White Sox, a little bias towards Chicago here. Sorry, but those are the two names that come to mind where those guys jump like 50 plus. I mean, Crochet, just an insane jump this season from becoming a reliever to now throwing, you know, over 100 innings in the major leagues is wild. But I would say, I think when both of those cases, what you had was very good oversight of that pitcher. And what I mean by that is, like, I believe Justin Steele stayed at the Arizona facility for the entire offseason for the Cubs. Garrett Crochet, you know, I imagine he either had third-party trainers he was working with, or he was very close to Brian Bannister, who was the mastermind behind the Giants rebuild, pitch for the Red Sox, et cetera. It's, you know, long history of being one of the sharper baseball minds on the pitching side. So I imagine, you know, he was either attached to Bannister's hip or something along those lines. So that's to say, like, if you want to get King Kent to 140 innings next year, like, you got to have that guy for the next 5 months under very good supervision as to like what he's throwing in terms of capacity, how he's ramping up, what his offseason looks like. That like immediate feedback on the strength conditioning side is super, super important. It's just you can't force him to do that, you know? And I also don't think there's any knock against him if he doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to stay in Florida all offseason or whatever, or wants to go work with his own trainers. But having a team understanding of a guy's capacity in offseason is like probably the one thing that most coaches would absolutely love and give them a lot more confidence in how a guy would actually perform from an inning standpoint and what workload he'd be able to tolerate in a subsequent season.
I mentioned that you've got a history with Driveline, and a number of Cardinals players have trained at Driveline in the offseason. Driveline's fantastic from a technology standpoint, from a data standpoint, everything. They've got everything you need. I'm not asking you to trash on the Cardinals here, but you have to be somewhat familiar. Like, how far behind have the Cardinals fallen when it comes to the use of technology and things like that, stuff that Heim Bloom has been brought in to kind of oversee and fix?
It's a great question. I can't say I have any great answer for you here that's going to, you know, I think appease your listeners. I would say they're behind. I think a lot of the time what I look at on the minor league side, we'll go pitching specifically too, is like, I find it hard sometimes to bucket teams, and I think the way I kind of look at it is like you have probably about seven teams, I'd say, that are what I would consider in the top tier of pitching development, and then you probably have like four teams maybe or so that are in the bottom, and then you have like this black box in the middle where you have a lot of teams that like get results, don't really do anything great, but like seem to produce occasionally some pretty good pitchers, and those are the most confusing teams, I would say. And I mean, there's a lot of teams in there. You know, I think people would have differing opinions on them. The bottom teams are probably like Oakland, Chicago White Sox currently. The Angels are down there. Colorado Rockies are down there. The top teams are the Dodgers. Let's see. I'd say the Red Sox are picking it up. Rays. I think the Tigers are on the up and up. You know, I'm saying teams that are on like the up and up. Cleveland, Seattle, the Yankees are pretty good, I would say. So you almost like take that middle batch of teams and put like an uptrend or a downtrend arrow on it. And I got to say, like, I think the Cardinals might be one of the teams that are in that mass, but with, I would like to think an uptrend with, given the fact you guys are bringing in Heim, you know, I think that's a great sign. It's the same reason I would put an uptick on like a team like the White Sox. on the minor league pitching side specifically. He's like, you have Brian Bamster, you know, and they put a big proposal out to Jerry Reinsdorf to have a huge overhaul on the tech and development side. So you're not as far behind as the White Sox, from my understanding, which is good. That's very good. Yeah. But you're probably not as far ahead as, like, the Minnesota Twins, who I think are another team that maybe isn't brought up a lot on the pitching development side, but they're very, very well integrated with Kinetrax and biomechanics. They pull all that back to stealth models, et cetera. They basically are like driveline of the MLB to some extent, in my opinion. So you're somewhere in between there. You know, if you want to put an uptrend arrow or downtrend arrow, I think you could debate either way. But I would probably put an uptrend on them and put them in the middle of the pack.
If the answer is, well, you're not the White Sox, that's not always the best answer.
I know. No one is the White Sox. Unless you're like the Rockies or the Angels, maybe. So I don't know.
Two teams that you mentioned were the Rays and the Red Sox, and those are Bloom's former teams. Obviously, he had a lot to do with helping build out the Rays, and then I would give him a lot of credit for what the Red Sox minor league system has turned into, even though he's not there now. So that's another reason for Cardinals fans to be, I think, pretty excited.
Oh, I think he is the get of all gets. He might be the hire of the offseason. And this is coming from somebody who covers the Cubs on a daily basis. You know, like, I think that is a fantastic hire. And we saw that with Breslow last year going to the Red Sox from the Cubs, you know, and him picking up Bailey. And, you know, I think we're going to see it in the next couple of years in terms of what the White Sox do on the pitching side. Again, like, I think we think of the players as the hires, but there are teams that, like, make sweeping overhauls in the minors and are very quickly within, like, a two-year period back to competitive. And those things happen, I don't want to say pretty regularly, but we're getting to the point where, like, it kind of happens, you know, every couple of years. Like, the Royals are a great example of that. That's a team that made a pretty big overhaul on the pitching side, jumped the velocity a lot, started using a lot more sliders. You know, they got to the playoffs, and that team well overperformed. Maybe they just beat up on the White Sox, but, like, I don't think you could take away from the fact that they were, like, a top five team in FIP at the major league level. They throw hard in the minors. Like, they have a lot of good things going for them. The Marlins are another team I'd look at on the up and up, where, like, they purged everybody, you know? Like, Bendix got in there late, the new GM there, earlier this season, right? Didn't really make a lot of changes, and now he's able to put his stamp on the org. He comes from the Rays. So you're seeing, like, you know, they have the Shanny coaching tree in football, right? Big fantasy football guy here. So this is my extent of my football knowledge is what the Shanny tree is. But Mike Shanahan, et cetera, Kyle Shanahan, a lot of the guys coming from that tree. I think what we'll end up with is, like, maybe a Heim Bloom tree, or, like, maybe it's an Andrew Freeman tree is probably the way to do it right now.
Yeah.
Who's front office with the Dodgers, guys who were under his brass that then kind of form their own angles and iterations of what he did and apply it to a variety of other teams and make all those teams better. And I just think that's the reality of it. Sometimes the biggest hires are the ones that are not directly on the field.
Last thing for you, just because you're connected to the Cubs with Marquis. Cardinals have already said payroll's going down. We know about the Pirates. We know about the Reds, even with the Reds bringing in Francona this year. It feels like the Brewers are going to maybe trade a Devin Williams. Maybe even they move on from a William Contreras this offseason. The team that scares me from an offseason perspective, and I hate the words that are about to come out of my mouth, are the Cubs. Craig Counsell openly spoke about at the end of the year that, you know, they've got to bring in players to be a 90-plus win team. It feels like they're leaning into a potential big offseason. Am I evaluating that situation correctly from St. Louis?
I'd say you are. I'd say that it maybe comes with more complications than maybe people realize. This is just my opinion purely. It's just they have a lot of positions that are, like, seemingly tied up, in my opinion. The corners are tied up. If Bellinger opts in, I have no inside information, but my assumption is that he probably will. There's a good chance he will. He'll play probably right field. Suzuki probably goes to DH. Michael Busch is at first base. Like, you just traded for Isak Paredes at third. You're up the middle's tied up. Pete's in center. Tapp's going to probably win a third gold glove and left. You know, like, I don't know where you upgrade. You know what I mean? On the offensive side specifically, and that's kind of where most of the criticism around the organization, I would say, was this year, was that weird two-month stretch where they just couldn't hit. The park played at Wrigley very odd this year in terms of suppressing offense. The argument there is that everyone was playing with the same park. It's not like just the Cubs. You know, the opponents going into Wrigley were also had a little offense. So it's one of those things where, like, if they're going to make a big splash, it's got to come probably through trade. And I just am curious to see who exactly would be shopped, you know? Like, that's kind of where I end up. Like, maybe if they pick up a Max Fried and a strong bullpen piece, and then that's your big splash. And it's like, okay, cool. Like, I'd say that's a big splash too. But I don't think it necessarily solves the problem of, like, the offense for the last couple of years hasn't been amazing, you know? So I'm just wondering whether there's another move here that we can't fully piece together to the roster to interpret what you're saying about Council saying this could be a big offseason for them. So I'm curious to see what they do. I feel like they got some moves in the bag, and I'm very fascinated to see what they are.
Lance Brozdowski, he is a player development analyst with Marquee Sports Network. Follow him on Twitter at Lance Broz. His YouTube channel is at Lance Broz as well, and it is fantastic. And if you really want to dive into player development, he had a video here recently that dove into Luke Weaver and what has led to him being as effective as he's been. It's great stuff. Lance, I could have talked to you for probably an hour. Hopefully we can get you on at another point in the future, but we really appreciate you coming on tonight.
Thanks for having me. Take care, guys.
Awesome. Very good. That's Lance Brozdowski joining us on the program. We'll take a break. Have more in just a moment. It's a Gray Bar Sports Open Line on KMOX. Get on a Gray Bar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. Lots going on tonight. The Blues are underway against the Minnesota Wild. First home game of the year, and also ALCS game number two. It is underway as well as Cleveland and New York match up against each other. The Yankees winning yesterday. Nothing against Cleveland. I'm rooting for Cleveland in this series. I like that team. They're fun. Stephen Vogt, when I was covering the Brewers, he spent a little bit of time in Milwaukee. I got to know him a little bit. He's a really, really good guy. So, I've never run away from this. I am somebody that if I get to know people and I like them, I do at times root for them. I think that's human, by the way. Sometimes people criticize me for that sometimes. No, I know you. I like you. I root for you. That's the way it works. One of my biggest things is that I have a hard time with sometimes is, so as sports fans, what's like the most amazing thing in the world? When our teams do well, when they win championships, when they win big games. So when I am friends with somebody, that means I care for them. That means I want them to experience good things. And to me, in my world that is so connected to sports, if I want my friends to experience good things, that means I want good things for the teams that they root for. Now, not at the expense of my team. I'm still self-centered enough that no, I'm not gonna be happy for you because you root for another team and they just beat the Cardinals. That's not where I'm gonna go. But I took some grief on social media when the Brewers made the playoffs. I don't root for the Brewers. Let me be very clear. I still get that sometimes, by the way. Like, people knew that I came here from Milwaukee, even though I grew up in St. Louis. I still get it sometimes where, like, I'll be talking to somebody, and they'll be like, so do you really root for the Brewers? No, I don't root for the Brewers. Of course I don't root for the Brewers. In fact, Kyle Sixta is here. I think you can confirm that I have very strong feelings in that area.
I can. You hopped on yesterday and you said you're rooting for the Mets to make it to the World Series to continue the tradition of all teams beating the Brewers make it to the World Series.
Yes. So I have I'm very well documented in that area. But having lived in Milwaukee for 6 years, I can at least appreciate for my friends who live there, because I have many close friends who still live there. When the Cardinals were not in the playoffs this year, I appreciated for my friends that they were able to enjoy postseason baseball. It was a very weird thing because I was able to appreciate for them what was going on. All the while, when the Mets beat the Brewers, I was pretty happy. I was pretty happy. If you listened to this show every single day, there was a day that Maria Kina was doing news, and she started laughing in the middle of news, and she later blamed me for it, which was right. It was because I was celebrating here in the studio as the Mets had done something against Milwaukee. So that's the that is the life that that I live. I like to see my friends have their teams be successful because I care for them and I want them to have the joy of having teams that do well. But there are certainly times where there are teams that no matter what, I would just rather them not do especially well for various reasons. I have been more entertained, by the way. I think the Yankees are going to win this series. I want Cleveland to win, but I think the Yankees are the World Series favorite right now. I think, with all due respect to the Guardians and what they did this season, and what a fantastic year for them, it does feel like this is the Yankees series all the way. I don't know on the other one. The NLCS, to me, it's a toss-up. The Dodgers should be the better team, but when the Dodgers have to roll out a bullpen game every once in a while, when the Mets have shown like this magical ability here in the postseason to do things, I don't know. This is a series that the fact that the Mets were able to steal one of those games in Los Angeles, that was a good moment for them. And man, if they can steal tomorrow when the Dodgers have Walker Buehler on the mound, they've got Severino. And what a step forward that would be for the Mets and what was supposed to be a transitional year as David Stearns puts his like players and his system basically in place. It already has been fantastic for the Mets that they've been able to go this far. So, by the way, the Mets are actually favored in tomorrow's game. So we'll see what will happen with that. All right, one more break. We'll come back and we will wrap up hour number one of the program. Hour number two will feature a college basketball conversation with Jerry Palm. We'll also hear from Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes. That's all in the 7 o'clock hour. This is the Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
Starting to wrap hour number one of the program. In hour number two, we'll talk college basketball with Jerry Palm. And we'll hear Patrick Mahomes talk about hair care. I'm not joking, by the way. That full conversation with Patrick Mahomes that he does with our sister station, 96.5 The Fan in Kansas City. We've got that for you at about 7:35 or so. Situation with the Tampa Bay Rays is interesting. If you haven't been following along, Hurricane Milton ripped off the roof of Tropicana Field. And two things on that. First off, Jim Bowden tweeted today. I'll read from his tweet. Hurricane Milton damage to the roof at Tropicana Field is a bigger deal than most understand. It would cost nine figures to replace, and moving into a new park in a few years doesn't make sense. Rays can't play there with no draining system for rain. Where will they play in 2025? Now, I threw out the idea of the Sauget Rays, but I don't know how far that's really going to go right there. But in all seriousness, they're building a brand new ballpark. They finally got the deal done. They've got the financing. They've got everything. It's happening. Can you go spend nine figures to fix a roof on that ballpark when you're moving into a new ballpark in two or three years? I don't think so. That ballpark has zero drainage. Zero drainage. So you can't play. You can't just be like, okay, it's an open air field for the next 2 years until they move out. There, if rain comes down, there is nowhere for the rain to go. So it cannot be an open air field. It's going to take nine figures to fix. If this tweet from Jim Bowden is correct, I don't know where they're going to play. We were talking about this in the KMOX newsroom earlier today. Our own Sean Malone threw out the idea. Maybe they just share with the Miami Marlins for 2 years. But then our fearless leader, Steve Moore, said, is that really what you want to do when you're building a new ballpark and you want people buying season tickets? You really want the team hundreds of miles away for the 2 years leading to the new ballpark? You're not building excitement that way. Do they share with a minor league team in the area? We're going to see the Oakland A's share with the Sacramento Rivercats. It's possible. But that's a situation to watch out for. One other note on this, by the way, the seven Cownose Stingrays that are part of a habitat at Tropicana Field, they're part of a touch tank there. They survived the hurricane and they have been relocated safely to a habitat at the Florida Aquarium. In a statement from the team, they said, we're pleased to report the Cownose Stingrays handled the storm well. With the Tampa Bay Rays support, our staff was able to provide on-site care over the past several days, and today we brought them safely back to the aquarium. That statement was from the Florida Aquarium, excuse me. But yes, you can be happy to know that the actual stingrays that live at Tropicana Field during the season, they are alive, they are safe, and they are back at the friendly confines of the Florida Aquarium. Don't know if they're ever going to go back to Tropicana Field. nobody might ever go back to Tropicana Field. This is the Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
Back at it here on a Tuesday night. We'll continue to keep you updated on what's going on in both baseball and hockey. Not great news right now when it comes to the St. Louis Blues. They are matched up against the Minnesota Wild. The Wild have a 1-0 lead with about 4 minutes to go in the first period. And then in baseball, the Yankees and Guardians are matched up against each other. Yankees strike first. They have a 1-0 lead that game in the top of the second. If the Yankees lead, they will take a 2-0 series lead. Today, Rawlings, St. Louis-based Rawlings, announced the finalist for Gold Glove Awards, and the Cardinals do have some representation. Three players are finalists for Gold Gloves. Mason Winn, who I think should win the Gold Glove at shortstop, and if he doesn't, it's not like a miscarriage of justice. There were some really, really good shortstops in the National League, for sure. But when you look at some of the numbers for Winn, and look, some... there are some defensive metrics that definitely skew towards other shortstops in the National League. So I don't think this is just an easy, hands down, without a doubt, Mason Winn is going to win the Gold Glove. But when you take the totality of his season and what he is able to do, especially from a defensive run saved standpoint, all those things, I do think that he is the rightful winner of this year's Gold Glove at the shortstop position. And I'm hopeful. I am hopeful that he will find a way to that he's going to find himself with a Gold Glove this year. Other Cardinals to be finalists. So again, the finalists at each position, there's three of them. Nolan Arenado is a finalist at third base as he looks to add an 11th Gold Glove. He did not win one last year for the first time in his career. I don't know if he's overly likely to win it this year. At the halfway point of the season, I wouldn't have even thought he'd be a finalist. It gets lost in the season. And there's an anti-Arenado bias out there from some contingent of the Cardinals fan base. There's people who don't like the way he runs to first base and things like that. And there's like this feeling that his play defensively has dropped off between maybe some of the optics on the way he does get to first base at times and the fact that the offensive numbers haven't quite been there. His second half of the season defensively was, by any metric, as good of a defensive season, half season at third base for anybody in Major League Baseball. So is there a chance that he kind of wins it between reputation and what he did in the second half of the season? Is that enough for him to win the award? Maybe. Not out of the realm of possibility. And then I never know, like, not that we really can like prognosticate the Gold Glove Awards, but Brendan Donovan is once again a finalist for the Gold Glove as a utility man. He won that just a couple seasons ago. It's more challenging when somebody is a utility guy and plays a bunch of different positions on how you evaluate how good they are defensively. That's, to me, that one almost feels like it's more optics than anything else. And Donovan has won it once before, so he's looking for a second Gold Glove. Michael Ciani, of note, not a finalist in center field. And if you remember, there was a little bit of consternation when he got injured because you have to have a minimum number of innings played by a certain date to be eligible for a Gold Glove. And when he got injured, it looked like that he was not going to get the innings needed for the Gold Glove Award. Well, later it came out that they were able to count his non-center field innings as innings that would count towards Gold Glove eligibility. And all that went down, and it was something that we talked about a lot. And what do we learn? That he's not even a finalist. This is one of those things where when you go back through the season for the Cardinals, like there's a lot of things that if they would have gone differently, the season could have gone differently. Just in the sense that the Cardinals could have potentially been a team that snuck into the playoffs. I mean, there are a few series and a few losses. If you want to play that game, and any team can go play it, but there's moments in this season for the Cardinals that if things just would have gone a little bit differently, things could have looked a whole lot different. You know, I specifically think about that Cincinnati series late in the season where they weren't very good. I think about that four-game series that they had against Chicago right at the beginning of August, just after the trade deadline. They lost 3 of 4 against the Cubs. To me, that kind of felt like the beginning of the end, just considering the momentum. But you also think back to where this team was when Michael Ciani went down. And Ciani was giving the team a solid lift. He was putting up his best offensive numbers of the year. And he did not have a very good offensive season. I would contend, as good as he is defensively, once the Cardinals get back to being a team that wants to contend on an every year basis, I would contend that they need more offensive production out of center field, no matter how good defensively Michael Ciani is. But he was putting up respectable offensive numbers at the time that he got injured, and he was making multiple plays a week that were impact defensive plays. You know, one of the conversations that we had earlier on in the season was when the Cardinals were looking for hitting, do you move Lars Nootbaar to center field? And my take on that was always, yeah, you do, because as good as Michael Ciani is defensively, he'll make a play every 3 or 4 days that Lars Nootbaar won't make. He's a really good defensive center fielder, but for you to have that kind of impact in the outfield, it's a play every few days. He was at a point where I started changing a little bit because he was making so many high-level, game-changing defensive plays. He gets injured. He eventually comes back. When he got injured, the Cardinals were on a pretty good run. It felt like they still had a very legit chance. He came back. I'm not trying to sit here and tell you that if Michael Ciani doesn't get injured, the Cardinals are in the playoffs. That's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is it felt like everything changed when he came back. He was not the exact same guy. He was a good defensive center fielder, but it wasn't like he was making these game-changing plays every other game or every game the way it felt like before then. Offensively, he was not putting up the numbers like he was putting up prior to the injury. So the point that I'm trying to get to here is if Ciani does not get injured and he is able to continue the run that he was on when he got injured, I think we're probably talking about Michael Ciani right now as a Gold Glove finalist. I don't know if he wins the award. That's a tough position to win the award, especially when you're not a kind of a, you know, brand name player like Michael Ciani is. Like, that shouldn't matter, but it does for voters. But if he doesn't get injured and he continues to impact games the way he was impacting them during that those few weeks when he was out, maybe it's a little bit of a different situation for him. While we're talking about the Cardinals, real quickly, this was announced yesterday. I don't think we really got into it on the show too much. Jimmy Crooks yesterday was named the Minor League Player of the Year. Quinn Matthews, the Minor League Pitcher of the Year. Kevin Wheeler and I were having a conversation about this today. We don't really know what the Cardinals are going to do in terms of possibly removing players from the roster who they might trade. If they trade Wilson Contreras, we already know that you got a couple guys who can handle that position at the big league level in Ivan Herrera and Pedro Páez, but you've got Jimmy Crooks on the way, and you would think that he's going to get the opportunity to start the season at AAA next year after he was at AA this year, put together just a fantastic offensive season, hitting .321. He was tops in the Texas League and a whole bunch of different areas and put together a great season. So he's not that far away. We're going to see Quinn Matthews this upcoming season. There continues to be an influx of young players that are going to impact this team. And because of the team kind of resetting things, I think some of these young guys are going to get bigger opportunities sooner, which there might be some growing pains, but at the same time, I'm excited to see what these guys can do at the big league level. I was excited to see Michael McGreevy this year. I was excited to see Gordon Grissett. Like, at some point, you got to get these guys to the big leagues. Not that anybody's been, you know, clamoring for Jimmy Crooks. He's just going through a normal developmental timeline. But that timeline might be accelerated a bit, especially if the team ends up trading Wilson Contreras this offseason, if he wants to be moved. That's a conversation that the Cardinals have to have with Contreras and Arenado and Gray, just where they're at in terms of how they feel. All right, we're going to switch gears. We're going to talk college basketball. We're going to do that with Jerry Palm from CBS Sports. He joins us in just a moment. This is a Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
It's better over here.
AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free, all on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Pay off up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port and trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
You got to take a listen to this. It's Squawk Pod.
That's right. CNBC's flagship business news show is a podcast, Squawk Pod.
This is CNBC Control 2.
It is not just the show, folks.
It might be even better because it's only audio.
Join me, Katie Kramer, as I take you inside the Squawk Box control room and beyond the headlines of our TV broadcast with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin every weekday.
Roll alpha.
Listen to CNBC's Squawk Pod free on the Odyssey app.
Back at it on a Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. Very happy to be able to go back to the guest line and welcome on one of our favorite guests. Covers college sports, college football, and college basketball for CBS Sports. He is at Jerry Palm. You follow him on Twitter at JPPalmCBS. Jerry, always great to talk to you. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Doing good. We wanted to talk mainly college basketball with you, but you're a Purdue guy. Purdue almost had one against Illinois this past weekend. Did you like the aggressive nature of decision making there at the end of the game for Purdue?
Yeah, it's, you know, when you've had the kind of year that they've had, you get an opportunity to win. You want to go ahead and just grab at it while you've got the momentum that they had in that second half. So. You know, it's funny. I mean, Purdue had been just grossly incompetent on both ends of the field until the second half of that game. They had scored 47 points in 4.5 games, counting the first half of that one, against FBS opponents that year, and then 46 after halftime. So hopefully they can keep that momentum against an outstanding Oregon team coming in on Friday.
We wanted to have you on to make talk mainly college basketball, the AP preseason poll being released earlier this week. These preseason polls, in the world of transfer portal and name, image, likeness, and these college basketball coaches seemingly remaking half, if not their entire roster, on an every year basis, how challenging is it to put together these polls? Because it feels like so often they do not reflect what the season ends up looking like.
Well, there's always a fair amount of dart throwing in preseason polls, right? I mean, I think it's even more true probably in football, you know, where you've got massive rosters and so many players playing and, you know, one injury and everything, you know, goes sideways. Even, you know, whatever you think may not come about. And there's always surprises in every season. That's what makes it fun, part of it anyway. So, you know, we'll see the teams that are usually good end up being in the rankings, in the preseason rankings, even, you know, teams that may have a lot of transition in a given year, you just have faith in the program to be what they're going to be. So some of that shows up in preseason polls and then the teams like, oh, say Florida Atlantic of a couple of years ago, you know, that it kind of came out of nowhere. You know, those are what make the regular season and the tournament fun.
Here locally, there's so much excitement about what's going to happen with St. Louis University basketball with Coach Schertz coming in and Robbie Avila being on the team and Isaiah Swope transferring in and another year of Gibson, Jimerson, guys like that. It's a SLU team that picked up some votes in the AP poll. They play in a league in the A-10 where you can put together a really good season and have success. What's your thought on the ceiling for this Billikens team?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see because, you know, you've got some good programs in that league already, like VCU and Dayton, and then, you know, SLU goes in and makes, I think, a pretty bold move in hiring Scherz away from Indiana State, where he did a terrific job, and
He brought some key guys with him, and, you know, with some of the players they have left over, that's a team that you would expect would be competitive in the regular season and perhaps for the regular season title in the A-10. That's certainly going to be one of the three or four teams that people are going to think, I think rightly so, have a chance to win that league, and we'll see. But that's just the kind of thing you were just talking about, you know, about how you could remake a roster, and it's easier in basketball when you only have, you know, 12-man rosters, that you can remake things in one off season and go from, you know, doormat to contender. Not that St. Louis was a doormat, but you know what I'm saying is you can really change the fortunes of a team in the transfer portal. And, you know, a probably even better example of that this year is like Louisville, which was just dreadful. One of the worst major conference teams in recent memory, even including DePaul, who's almost always that bad, went into the transfer portal and has completely remade their roster. And now this is a team that people think can compete for a spot in the NCAA tournament. And, you know, SLU is undergoing perhaps a similar transition, although not from the depths that Louisville started with.
Sometimes when you're in a city, there's some arrogance that goes along with that city. But I think a lot of people in St. Louis feel like with the history of the program, with a beautiful arena, Chaffetz Arena, with more facilities being built, with a pretty good NIL system being put in place, that this is a bit of a sleeping giant type situation. Do you, and in a metropolitan area all at the same time, is that correct thinking, or is this still a program that is going to have some challenges in front of it?
Well, they've just got to reprove themselves. I've always thought of the Billikens as having a very good program, and then they've come out on hard times the last few years. But I've always thought of them as being generally very competitive, and maybe they can get back to that level again this year where they could be very competitive in their league and perhaps good enough even to make an NCAA tournament. That's always been my view of St. Louis basketball, is that is a competitive program, and perhaps now they can get back to those heights.
Illinois is the top team receiving votes, so the de facto number 26 team. It seems like Coach Underwood has that thing rolling pretty well right now.
Yeah, the Big Ten is going to be, you know, it's been all Purdue the last couple of years, back-to-back conference championships by three games in the regular season. Zach Edey's off to the Memphis Grizzlies now. Purdue will be a lot different, and yet still the pick to win the league. But I think it's going to be really competitive this year. There's probably at least six teams that can win the Big Ten, I think, this year, and Illinois is certainly among them. They've got a great program. But they're, you know, they lost. Didn't they lose? I mean, Terrence Shannon is gone, right?
Yes.
Luke Good transferred to Indiana, I believe. So Damask is also gone. So they've got some work to do to rebuild that roster. But you know, Brad Underwood has done a great job with that program. They're competitive every year. They figure to be right in that hunt for the Big Ten title this year.
Last thing for you, look at Missouri 2 years ago, year one of Dennis Gates. It was fantastic. Year two, it took a step back, a big step back. He's got a great recruiting class coming in. Do you feel like this is a Tigers program that can have a bounce back this year?
Yeah, it's going to be tough. I mean, they're going to be better. I don't know how much of that is going to show up in the conference standing because the SEC is just loaded this year. Mizzou could finish 10th and be markedly better than last year. So and it's just going to have to see how well those young guys can get together and be a cohesive unit by the time SEC play rolls around, because the margin for error in that league is going to be really small this year. But the fact that he's been able to bring in some talent, some really talented guys in a good recruiting class, is hope for Mizzou fans that this program is going in the right direction.
We love talking with Jerry Palm. You read him at CBSSports.com, covering college football and college basketball. Jerry, thank you for being so gracious with your time. Hopefully we can catch up with you again down the line.
Sure. Thanks. Anytime.
You bet. That's Jerry Palm joining us here on the program, and we appreciate him spending a few moments with us here tonight. By the way, a little bit of news today when it comes to Billiken's basketball. Stu Durando from the Post-Dispatch and STL Today tweeted this out earlier this afternoon. SLU is going to have an exhibition game against Rockhurst coming up on Friday. But from an injury standpoint, Robbie Avila is not going to play in that game. Dylan Warlick also will not play in that game. Avila has not started non-contract deals quite yet. So he is still working his way back. You give him as much time as he needs, because that's the guy who's going to be such a key part of what the Billikens are trying to do this season. There's some other players who are dealing with a little bit of a bang up here, bang up there, but hopefully that team is fairly healthy by the time they get into the season, and you can take some time and you don't have to worry too much about the two exhibition games. They're going to play back-to-back exhibition games this Friday. They're going to host Rockhurst, I believe out of the Kansas City area, if I've got that right, and then Maryville is going to match up against them coming up a week from Friday on October 25th, and then they are going to open up their season in the Field of 68 opening day showcase when they take on Santa Clara. That's going to be on Monday, November 4th in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and of course, we here at KMOX are your home for St. Louis University Billikens basketball. I am ready. I am ready to hear Bob Ramsey and Earl Austin Jr. on the call of Billikens basketball sooner than later. And we're getting close. We are getting very, very close to the start of the season for the Billikens. All right. When we come back, it's our weekly interview that we get from our sister station, 96.5 The Fan in Kansas City, with Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes. Now, the Chiefs are coming off a bye week, so not a lot of football questions, but it's still Patrick Mahomes, and maybe you'll learn a thing or two about the Chiefs quarterback that you never knew before. He always speaks with Carrington Harrison, who is part of the team over there at 96.5 The Fan in Kansas City. You are going to hear from the Chiefs quarterback, Patrick Mahomes, and you might just hear some interesting bits of information from him. That's coming up next. This is a Gray Bar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
You got to take a listen to this. It's Squawk Pod.
That's right. CNBC's flagship business news show is a podcast, Squawk Pod.
This is CNBC Control 2.
It is not just the show, folks.
It might be even better because it's only audio.
Join me, Katie Kramer, as I take you inside the Squawk Box control room and beyond the headlines of our TV broadcast with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin every weekday.
Roll alpha.
Listen to CNBC's Squawk Pod free on the Odyssey app.
It's better over here.
After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
It's a Gray Bar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. My name is Matt Pauly. As we move along, taking you till 8 o'clock this evening, we'll have a full show again tomorrow, Thursday. We are shortened for Thursday Night Football, and then back with another two-hour show coming up on Friday night. The Chiefs are coming off a bye week. They are going to return to action, sitting with their undefeated 5-0 record. They match up against the 49ers on the road. That's a good game. That's going to be coming up on Sunday. Each week, we like to play for you a conversation that Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes has with Carrington Harrison, part of the team at 96.5 The Fan, our sister station in Kansas City. Let me pull back the curtain for you a little bit here. Generally speaking, if I am throwing to a pre-recorded interview like I'm doing right now, the way I would do it is I would like edit out the first question that's asked, and I would say, I would lead into the answer of that first question, and then whoever is interviewing, so in this case, Carrington Harrison, they would be asking the question. Like, that's how I generally throw to a pre-recorded interview. We're going to do things a little bit different this week with this conversation because the Chiefs were coming off the bye week, so there wasn't a whole lot of football to talk about. So I will hand things off to Carrington Harrison and let him ask the first question of Patrick Mahomes.
The number one question when I ask people, hey, what do you want Patrick to answer, is people want to know what your hair care routine is. So you wake up in the morning, you got to do something to your hair. Take us through the process.
Yeah, no, it's easy. It's just my normal head and shoulders, just like the commercial. I throw it in the hair, and then my hair just curls like this.
No, you got to do something to it. You got to put some gel in it. You got to do some comb stuff. Nobody just wakes up with it naturally curly like that.
No, honestly, it's just, you just do the shampoo, conditioner. I brush the sides a little bit, but other than that, my hair just naturally is curly. I didn't know until I grew the mohawk out that my hair was like this. It just kind of happened. And I liked it after that.
Have you ever, like, one day was, like, sitting down in the barber chair and you were like, man, it's time for me to switch things up?
Oh, I think about that all the time. Like, I know the Netflix show showed that. Like, I've wanted to cut my hair for a while now, but we've had a good thing rolling, and I don't like changing stuff up, so I'll keep it as long as we keep rolling.
All right, right now we're talking to the quarterback of the Kansas City Chiefs, Patrick Mahomes. What is your favorite Pop-Tart flavor?
I've never eaten a Pop-Tart in my entire life, so I think I'm going to have to change that at some point because everybody loves them. But Brittany loves them. I don't know what her favorite flavor is, but she loves them.
What was your, like, breakfast as a kid? Were you a cereal person? Were you, like, a bacon and eggs? Like, 8-year-old Patrick Mahomes, you're watching cartoons on a Saturday. What was your breakfast like?
I've never been a huge, like, breakfast at breakfast time person, but if it's like a brunch or a lunch or even a breakfast for dinner, I'm always the scrambled eggs, the bacon. I love a nice piece of toast or biscuit and gravy, kind of something like that. But I never eat really early in the morning. It's just more breakfast at lunch, breakfast for dinner for me.
Okay, it's good to know that you like bacon. One of the questions I had down, so Gail from 1 to 10, how crisp do you like your bacon? So 1 is super floppy, 10 is the crispiest, almost break your teeth off hard. How crispy do you like your bacon to be?
I would say probably closer to a 6 or a 7. I want it to be at least a little bit crispy. I don't want it overly done. I think it's too, like, 10 to me is too much. But I want it to be a little bit crispy, and then you got a little bit of floppiness in there, just nothing too crazy.
All right, I have never asked you this question. I'm excited because this is such a critical moment in every boy's life. I remember when I beat my dad one-on-one in basketball, and for game point, it was one of the hardest fouls that I had to earn that final bucket. Can you tell us the story of when you beat your dad in sports and something for the first time?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of, I think the story that I think about the most, I don't know if it was the first time I ever beat my dad, but the first time I beat him in golf, I think it was after I left college and after my first year playing in the NFL. Just because, I mean, in basketball and stuff like that, that stuff happened, I think, probably in high school, but that was the one that I think hurt him the most, was me beating him on the golf course. And then now I beat him all the time, and it really eats at him because he was able to beat me in golf our entire life, and now that I play so much in the off season, I've gotten pretty good. But he'll beat me every once in a while. But for the most part, I got him on the golf course. But I mean, it's hard, dude. My dad's 6'4", a professional baseball player, got college offers in basketball, I mean, and football. So it was hard for me to beat him growing up in anything, and he wasn't letting me beat him in anything either.
I know that you have some time to get ready for this, but are you mentally prepared for Bronze is going to have this story about you? Like, one day, it's going to catch you off guard, and Bronze is going to beat you with something, and you're going to have to tell this story to somebody else.
Yeah, that day's not coming anytime soon, so I'll think about that in about 18, 20 years whenever he gets a little older.
Whenever you played Mario Kart, who was your Mario Kart character?
I was a Yoshi guy myself. I don't know why. I liked the vibes that he had. And I felt like, for some reason, when I was a kid, I felt like he was the fastest in the car, even though that makes no sense.
No, that actually makes sense. I was Big Toad person for that reason. That stuff matters. You know, like Bowser or Donkey Kong, they were heavier. But yeah, like Yoshi and Toad, they were always a little lighter and faster.
That's what I thought. Like, I didn't know if that was a true fact or not, but in my head, I was like, if I can just outrun them, I don't have to worry about Donkey Kong or Bowser really getting to me. But it was a bit. I played it growing up, and then I played it a lot in college. We were finding all the shortcuts. I was looking up all the ways to cheat and win, and It was a lot of fun to play.
What was you guys' college video game? For me, it was Halo 3 and Smash Bros. We played way too much of that in college. Whenever you guys had free time, what was the game that you played?
I played a ton. I got a ton of 2K, just basketball. We played a little bit of FIFA as well. I think one of the World Cups happened when I was in college, so we played a ton of that at that point. But I was a ton of just 2K basketball, just going out there, either doing the My Career or even just like we would play like just like we'd play like just the regular like teams. And we'd do that for hours on hours, man. Probably hurt my grades a little bit playing so much.
All right, this might be the toughest question I've ever asked you. These are the two scenarios. You and Travis can play at Augusta, or you can play with Tiger at Pebble Beach. Which one would you pick?
I feel like it's cheating because I've played Augusta a couple times now. So I would play with Tiger because I haven't played with Tiger yet. So I gotta see what Tiger's like in person. Haven't even got to meet him, and I want to ask him about some of the stuff that he did as far as his career and how he dominated for so long.
So I didn't know this. I didn't know you had played Augusta. The last time I asked you about it, you hadn't played at Augusta. Now you've played it multiple times. What is it like?
It's everything that it's advertised to be, man. It's a special place, and I think obviously the golf course is unreal, and it's stuff that it looks like it's literally made in a factory because it's so nice. But I think just me growing up watching golf and like seeing all these shots, every time I'm at a spot, I'm like, Bubba Watson hit one here, or Tiger Woods hit one here, or whoever it is, and I think it was a magical place as a fan of golf that I am.
What hole was your favorite to play?
For me, I would say my favorite one was probably, I would just say 12, just because 12 is so iconic, Amon's Corner. But I had a lot of fun on 13 as well. I either parted or got like double or triple bogey or whatever, or I even got one birdie on there. All the holes are amazing, and I think I remember some of the shots more than anything.
A couple more questions here for Patrick Mahomes. We're doing our random no football questions for the bye week. Patrick, do you ever listen to podcasts?
I do sometimes. I either listen to podcasts or I listen to like audiobooks. So that's kind of what I listen to instead of music sometimes.
What's your favorite podcast? What was the most recent audiobook you listened to?
I'm listening to an audiobook called Captain's Class. So it's just about different captains throughout all sports and how they did it. And then as far as podcasts, I've been listening. My buddy Andrew Santino has one called Bad Friends. It's a little bit more comedy-based. And so sometimes if I'm trying to get a laugh in or something like that, I'll throw that on.
What is Sterling's favorite book? Whenever she's going to bed, I'm sure you read to her a couple times. Is there a book that she likes more than the other ones?
I wouldn't say that she has a favorite anymore. She's read so many now, and we have a million books for her that we read at night. But Bronze loves this book called Daddy Hugs. It's about this elephant and his dad kind of cruising around the jungle. So I'll give Bronze his favorite book right now. It's called Daddy Hugs.
All right, I have been wondering this because last year I asked you, did you have Venmo? Because that was a big debate around here. I am curious this. When was the last time that you bought something and you didn't buy it because it was too expensive? That happens to us on a regular basis. I'm wondering if this ever happens to you.
I don't know. I can't remember what I haven't bought just because of the price point. But I know like right now, like, as I've like built houses and stuff like that, that there's been a lot of times I've had to not get stuff because of the prices of things, and I'm just like, I just can't. No matter how much money I have, I just can't spend that much on that. So that's more of the things, like just kind of keeping it in the budget is something that I have to really kind of be tight on.
Okay, that makes sense. I am curious, how do you get clothes? Like, you can't go to the mall the way that regular people do. How do you buy clothes? Do you have a stylist that brings them to you? You know, because sometimes you got to go. You got to try it on. You got to see how it feels. You got to see how it fits. How do you buy clothes?
That's a Brittany Mahomes question. She styles me, so she's the one that gets all the clothes and gets them for me. And so she'll send me stuff, and she doesn't know if I'll wear it or not, and I'll just say yes or no. And if usually she has a good feel of what I would wear, and so she gets it, and then I get home, and it's in my closet, and then I just pick from that.
Halloween is right around the corner. Have you guys decided what you're doing for Halloween?
We have. It's a surprise. Sterling picked it, so it's a surprise, and the kids are super excited about it, and I'm going to be excited as well. I get to go get some candy with the kids.
What's your favorite candy?
My favorite candy is probably any type of, like, gummy, like, Sour Patch Kids, either Jolly Rancher gummies. Stuff like that is probably my favorite candy. And then every once in a while, I'll get some, like, Reese's Pieces or Reese,
Or M&M's or something like that, but mostly to the sour gummies.
All right, last thing here, and I appreciate you having a little fun with us today with our random questions. I have to ask you, has Taylor ever baked something for you, and what did she make you?
She never, like, baked anything specifically for me, she's made different treats that have been around my house, just like muffins and donuts and stuff like that. Her and, Sterling's a big baker as well, so they make some stuff together sometimes. And I'm not gonna say I don't eat them. So it is as good as everybody's talked about. She's great as it comes as far as it comes to baking.
That is the quarterback of the Kansas City Chiefs, Patrick Mahomes, joining us on the show today for our yearly We Don't Ask Football Questions interview. Patrick, we will get back to football next week, but it's the bye week. We like having a little bit of fun, man. We appreciate your time today.
Yeah, appreciate you, man.
That was Patrick Mahomes talking with Carrington Harrison from 96.5 The Fan in Kansas City, our sister station there. And they are the flagship station for the Chiefs. And, of course, we are St. Louis's home for the Chiefs. And we try to play that each and every week, Patrick Mahomes. And this week, not a lot of football talk, but you certainly learned a few other things during the course of that conversation. We'll take a break. We'll come back and we'll wrap up this edition of a Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
Back at it on the Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. My name is Matt Pauley. Just a couple minutes left in the program. Wanted to mention this real quick before we get out of here. Today, NFL owners allowed Tom Brady to officially purchase a minority stake in the Raiders. This has been kind of percolating there for over a year. There was some issue with if the Raiders were giving him too much of a discount. He gets about 5% control of the Raiders. So, doesn't bother me, like Tom Brady becoming an owner. Doesn't even bother me the idea that Mark Davis would give him a discount to get him as being part of the ownership group. Like, there's obviously value added having Tom Brady around. Here's what bugs me. So, and this has already been in place, actually. This is because this was in the process of happening. Before the season even got started, when it became clear that he was going to become minority owner of the Raiders, the NFL placed restrictions on Brady to be able to limit his access as a broadcaster because he was going to be a team owner. He is not permitted to attend production meetings in person or virtually. He also does not have access to team facilities or players or coaches. He is allowed to broadcast Raiders games if Fox were to ever do that, which seems unlikely, as bad as the Raiders are. But he has to abide by league constitution and bylaws that prohibit public criticism of officials and other clubs. I have a problem with that. And we make too much of broadcasters. We really do. That, like, Kevin Wheeler and I talk about this all the time. The Fox has loves to tell people that Tom Brady is their top analyst. Are more people watching Fox because Tom Brady is there? I don't think so. Like, the people are there to watch the game. As long as the broadcast is not distracting or makes you turn it off, people are there for the game. But by becoming a part owner, Brady cannot fully do the job of the analyst. When he has to abide by league constitution as an NFL owner, when he has to abide by league constitution and bylaws prohibiting public criticism of officials and other clubs, to me, that impacts his ability to do the job correctly. You have to go into the broadcast booth on a weekly basis, not feeling like there are things that you can't say because you happen to have ownership. And it just makes me wonder what the long play is for Tom Brady. Fox has invested a lot of money in him, a lot of time into him, a lot of marketing into him. They displaced a really, really good analyst in Greg Olson to be able to put Brady on that top crew. Can he really go through, can he, for the next 15 years, next 20 years, can he be the top analyst, but not being allowed to have public criticism of officials and clubs and things like that? Like, how do those two things jive together? So I have to wonder, long-term, is Tom Brady really going to stay in as a broadcaster, or is this going to be kind of a short-term thing for him? And I would really think at some point he's going to step away from the broadcasting if because of him being an owner, he has to do these various things. We'll see how this all, I guess, look, he's been doing it already. I can't say that I've sat and watched a lot of these Tom Brady games. I haven't noticed it yet, so maybe I'm making a big deal out of nothing, but I do think it is worth noting that he is not allowed to speak openly because of the ownership with the Raiders. All right, that's it for the program today. Thanks so much for being tuned in. Look forward to talking to you again tomorrow for another Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX.
It's better over here.
AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free, all on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Pay off up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
You got to take a listen to this. It's Squawk Pod.
That's right. CNBC's flagship business news show is a podcast, Squawk Pod.
This is CNBC Control 2.
It is not just the show, folks.
It might be even better because it's only audio.
Join me, Katie Kramer, as I take you inside the Squawk Box control room and beyond the headlines of our TV broadcast with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin every weekday.
Roll alpha.
Listen to CNBC's Squawk Pod free on the Odyssey app.